came into a conversation I was having with Helen Roach and with Barbara Eich, introduced himself, and has made himself very much a part of this organization over the last few years, and I take great pleasure in introducing him to you. I'm going to read you a little bit about him from the back of this form. I don't know if you've noticed, at the back of your conference program, there are small bios on many of our program speakers today. Bob O'Brien is an associate professor of English at West Virginia Wesleyan College. He has a BA from Louisiana State University and a PhD from the University of Iowa. He's taught at the State College of Northern Iowa and the University of Maryland in Asia and in Europe. His talk this morning promises to be a most interesting one. It's one of the few unspoken word that we've had in the last couple of years, and I'd like you to give him a nice welcome right now. Thank you. Bob?
There should be a pause button.
Is there any place it could be put where I could, on my right, where I could hit it with my right hand?
Can't get the cord to go that far.
Can it? Would it be possible? Oh, could it be possible to put it right here?
We'll try.
Better. You, with playing your long excerpts, can push one button and wait, whereas I'm going to be hitting the button about 30 or 40 times rather rapidly, and I like it a little bit closer at hand for me. And let's see, here's a play, and so stop. I'll be playing stop. That. Oops. Stop. Beast. We'll see how this works. Yesterday, I noticed that had a number of dedications of presentations. And it tempted me to make a dedication also to my ex-wife. If she had not created such difficulties in preventing me to see my children, I would have never put a cassette deck in my car and recorded Shakespeare's plays to listen to as I drove back and forth. And without that, I would have never discovered any of the things that I've discovered in the last 5 years or even thought about this association. I might make one little apology before I start. Thinking of the audio standards of the group that I'm dealing with, I was anxiously reviewing my tape yesterday morning and make sure that everything matched up with the text, and reached over with my little cassette deck with the controls away from me while I was watching the morning news and pushed a button, so that you're going to find that Edwin Booth is interrupted by the CBS morning news. Not a very long interruption, but I regret that it will be an annoying one. My piece is entitled Metrical Accuracy in Early Recordings of Shakespeare. You might think the subject of metrical accuracy an excessively arcane and specialist subject to consider before this group, which normally gives its attention to such more easily accessible and popular matters as the value of alternate takes of jazz recordings, or who made the oversized horn on the cylinder machine used by Mapleson at the Metropolitan Opera in 1902. However, I feel more confident about you than I do about some of my fellow literary scholars. True, I will need to use some of the technical jargon of metrical analysis, terms such as iamb, trochee, caesura, and foot, but the meaning of each of these terms is quickly grasped. The more difficult matter is to hear a rhythm and the disruption of a rhythm. That skill in hearing is what I suspect you have developed to a higher degree than I can expect in a scholar, in an audience of literary scholars. Allow me to briefly deal with the elements of metrical analysis of poetry before I deal with early recordings of Shakespeare. We can use the following line as a model of Shakespeare's blank verse. Now, I have a handout, and we'll be working with that from now on. Does anyone not have that handout?
It's...
Yes. We can use the following line. It's right there at the top of the first page. Mine eyes are full of tears. I cannot see. Richard II, 4-1-2-44. The line has 10 syllables. That is the most common number in blank verse. As we read the line, we note that each even-numbered syllable... Now, you see the second time I printed the line, I've numbered the syllables for you. As we read the line, we note that each even-numbered syllable is stressed more than the preceding odd-numbered syllable. Mine eyes are full of tears, I cannot see. Now, no person, I hope, would read this line using only two levels of stress. What we have here is merely a simplified representation. Using a four-level system of stress, we could represent two readings of the line as follows, and that you see in the next two lines. And if I may read them, with one as being the highest level of stress and four as being the lowest level, mine eyes are full of tears, I cannot see. Or the second version, mine eyes are full of tears, I cannot see. Now, those two radically different readings both conform to the simplified metrical pattern, and we should think of as metrical, so that simplified pattern that we see in the first of the three lines that I've marked would adequately represent either of those two versions below. Now, what we're suggesting here, by the way, is that there's a lot of room for originality at the same time as that there is a rather stable pattern that the actor should work within. The 10 syllables of this line can be divided into five groups called feet of two syllables. Each of these feet, in which the first syllable is comparatively unstressed and the second is comparatively stressed, is called an iamb, I-A-M-B. If the stress pattern is reversed, if the first syllable is stressed and the second unstressed, the foot is called a trochee. The trochaic foot is normally found in only two positions. It can occur as the first foot of a line, standing before the son of Bolingbroke. Or it can occur after a punctuated pause in the midst of a line, marked with a blot, damned in the book of heaven. I'm sure most of you are disposed to read the line I've just read. I'm sure most of you are disposed to read it in 11 syllables, giving two syllables to the final word, heaven. Shakespeare does write such lines. They are not uncommon at all. These three that you see next occur within the space of 10 lines. My gracious Lord, I tender you my service. I count myself and nothing else so happy. My heart this covenant makes, my hand thus seals it. Each case we have an 11th syllable that is unaccented. However, marked with a blot, damned in the book of heaven, is not such a line. Heaven is monosyllabic, heaven, not disyllabic, heaven. By the way, in that very interesting presentation we heard last night, I was struck by the fact that in that delightful little duet by Bunt and Rumford, marvelous names, in their delightful duet, they very precisely use the monosyllabic pronunciation hem each time. There is absolutely clear there. 20th century performers on the stage in plays, however, are almost consistent in their failure to recognize the need for a monosyllabic pronunciation of that word. Examples to illustrate this point are abundant. Here are a series also from Richard II.
And so defend thee, heaven, and thy valor.
The means that heaven yields must be embraced and not neglected.
Yeah, this one's dead.
If heaven would, and we will.
Okay, shall we stop and go back? This is probably done on only one channel, if there's any way you can deal with that. Okay, thank you. Tell me when to go. The lines you see at the bottom of that first page.
And so defend thee, heaven, and thy valor.
The means that heaven yields must be embraced and not neglected. Else, if heaven would, and we will not, heaven's offer we refuse.
Can you raise the volume?
But the searching eye of heaven is hid behind.
Let's go back and do it one more time.
And so defend thee, heaven, and thy valor.
The means that heaven yields must be embraced and not neglected. Else, if heaven would, and we will not, heaven's offer we refuse.
But when the searching eye of heaven is hid behind. By heaven, I'll hate him everlastingly.
I hope you... Do you recognize that each time that is a disyllabic word there? Yeah. He is so rather than as. So defend thee heaven rather than as defend thee heaven. We need to be attentive to such pronunciations, for to ignore them is to ignore the rhythm as well as the meaning of many a line. Blank verse does not accept three syllables in a single foot, except in the case of a line which has an extra unaccented syllable at the end of the final foot. Such lines are said to have a feminine ending. With this brief introduction to the prosody of blank verse, we can turn our attention to three performers who are among the first to record Shakespeare: Edwin Booth, Sir Henry Irving, and Ellen Terry. This is a most useful threesome to use. Edwin Booth was the most famous American performer of Shakespeare's works, and Sir Henry Irving was the most famous Shakespearean actor in England. Ellen Terry was the most famous Shakespearean actress of the time, and the three were together on the stage in 1882 in a famous production of Othello, in which Terry played Desdemona, and Booth and Irving alternated on successive nights in the roles of Othello and Iago. We have very little from these great performers, but the scraps that we have give us some hints regarding the differences between American and British acting styles. I will focus on a very specific matter. My study of recent recordings of Shakespeare's works reveals that today's performers have almost no idea of when they are reading in meter and when they are reading out of meter. Unnecessary and useless extra syllables clutter every set of recordings I have examined. In reading the sonnet at the beginning of Romeo and Juliet, Sir John Gielgud misreads three of the last eight lines, and Sir Laurence Olivier misreads the first line he utters in the movie he made of Hamlet. We know that Shakespeare's audience was exceedingly attentive to meter and to the performer's attention to meter. I have been concerned with identifying when we lost this aural sensitivity, which was common less than four centuries ago. My efforts to identify the origin of our lost orality has led me to go back as far as we can go in recordings of Shakespeare, to Booth, and Irving and Terry. My study has led me to blame Edwin Booth for a significant portion of our insensitivity to the music of Shakespeare's verse. To make clear the basis of that assertion, I must play a recording of the only understandable speech from Edwin Booth. It is a recording of Othello's speech to the Venetian Senate. According to a letter Booth wrote to his daughter Edwina, he made two recordings in compliance with her entreaties. This was one of them. He evidently made the two recordings while sitting alone in a Chicago hotel room in March of 1890. Both cylinders are currently in the Edwin Booth collection at the Players Club in New York. One cylinder is a recording of a speech from Hamlet, but it is not understandable. The other cylinder was dubbed onto a 10-inch 78 by a Harvard professor, F.C. Packard, in the early 1930s. That 78 seems to be the source of subsequent reissues on long play records. Here is the entire speech. The text as Shakespeare wrote it is found on the first page of the accompanying handle. Well, that'll be the second page for you. There's the CBS Morning News. He's just gone past where I have three marked. I noticed listening to that when typing up the handout, I left out one line that occurs after you see 8 and 9 in the margin. There's a another line that I left out, but that will not be important to the presentation here. Booth read it. The recording confirms the 19th century description of Booth's style. His future wife, Mary Devlin, remarked to him that, quote, "The conversational, colloquial school you desire to adopt is the only true one," unquote. Although he was said to be guilty of rant from time to time during his early years, during his maturity as an actor, he adopted a low-key style consistently and with considerable success. In this recording, he uses a very narrow range in volume and in rate. Run-on lines are read without any pause, and the pause of suspension, which was used by 18th century actors and which was recommended by Samuel Sheridan, is nowhere evident, as it is evident, for instance, in Olivier's version of the same speech. Although the reading does not seem unusually rapid, comparison with other versions reveals that it is firmly paced. The passage consists of 58 lines, lines 76 through 94, and 128 through 168. The reading consumes 3 minutes and 28 seconds. 3 minutes, 28 seconds, far briefer than the 4 minutes and 16 seconds Olivier needed for the same passage. You think what that would do to an entire performance. It'd increase it by about 1 hour. Or the 4 minutes and 7 seconds used by Frank Silvera in the Shakespeare Recording Society version. However, it is about the same length as the Paul Robeson version. The pronunciation used in the recording is significant. One of the most striking characteristics is that my and me are usually homonyms, as in the following passage.
The story being done, he gave before the kings of world.
However, the last time my occurs in the passage, and by the way, these are marked in your text. The next one will be at 2, yes. The last time my occurs in the passage, it is clearly pronounced as we pronounce it.
Should but teach him how to tell my story up.
Kukeritz and Dobson assure us that me and my were homonyms for Shakespeare. However, the older pronunciation is not necessary to maintain the meter, and its antique quality is needlessly distracting. The inconsistency doesn't help either. Other words which sometimes cause difficulties for the reader of Shakespeare are sometimes handled quite gracefully and sometimes quite ineptly. Words ending in en, such as seven, s-e-v-e-n, heaven, h-e-a-v-e-n, and een, e-v-e-n, frequently cause difficulty for players. Each of these words is monosyllabic for Shakespeare, seven, heaven, and een. In the following line, the monosyllabic pronunciation of seven is neatly handled, and the line has an impressive grace. However, Booth unnecessarily violates the meter of a later line when he fails to use the monosyllabic pronunciation of een.
I run it through from the voice, please.
The same error occurs with the treatment of heaven in that heaven had made her such a man, she thanked me. Please pronounce the following three words to yourself as I spell them. A-R-E. O-U-R. Then H-O-U-R. For most Americans, the first word is monosyllabic, R, whereas the second and third are disyllabic, our. For Shakespeare, the three words are monosyllabic homonyms. However, the speaker in the recording clearly violates the meter by using the disyllabic pronunciation of our. Let me say that the monosyllabic pronunciation of each of these words, our, used for all three, is currently available in both British and American standard usage. Right after I discovered this and was terribly excited about what I had found, I used to delight every morning listening to the morning news, and in Wheeling, West Virginia, there would be a short excerpt with a man from the employment office come on, and he would every morning say something of the sort that we have a notice calling for a clerk who will be paid $3.97 an hour. Very clearly monosyllabic. But you'll notice that Booth uses the disyllabic pronunciation in the following line at passage 6. The speaker also neglects needed syncopation of medial vowels. The word spelled S-E-R-I-O-U-S-L-Y is a four-syllable word for most of us, seriously. However, Shakespeare expected it to be a three-syllable word, seriously, in the following line. A more difficult line occurs somewhat earlier, of hairbreadth scapes in the imminent deadly breach. The meter requires that imminent be reduced to imminent, and that the preceding preposition and article be reduced to a single unstressed syllable. The line can be handled quite gracefully, as Paul Robeson showed.
Food of hair bred escape to the imminent deadly breach.
This grace is conspicuously absent from the Booth recording. Three lines earlier, another problematic line occurs. Allow me to compare the way the line appears in a modern text with the way it appears in the first folio. And this, let's see. Yes, you'll see this, I hope. Okay. At the end of the second Booth page. You can see it down there after the line. There's a copy right there. Here's a copy if you'd like.
No, I just want to make sure everything's okay.
After the line, you see the way it's frequently printed in modern text. And then below it is the way that it's printed in the first folio with the words jammed together. I'm just not perfectly sure of how much significance to give to that jamming together, but it's certainly what's required in reading the speech.
What is the date of Booth's recording?
1890, probably March 1890. The modern printing misleads Booth and every other actor I have heard to read the line as six trochees, trochaic hexameter, a bizarre anomaly in this speech. Closer attention to the line would have led the speaker to read the line more euphoniously as a regular iambic pentameter line with an extra unaccented syllable in the 11th position, a common variation. Two final alterations of the language deserve mention. In line 93, for such proceedings I am charged with all, Booth reverses the position of I and am. But the same error occurs in the readings by Robeson, Olivier, and Silvera, although it doesn't occur in any edition of Shakespeare's works. The most obvious result of placing the auxiliary verb before the subject is that the more common grammatical construction is replaced with a construction that is distinctly less common and more formal. Two other changes are unique to the version we are concerned with. Shakespeare wrote, "Rough quarries, rocks, and hills whose heads touch heaven. However, our speaker says, high rocks, rough quarries, and hills whose heads touch heaven. The result is that the meter of the third foot is needlessly disrupted. This change is most important, for it shows Booth substituting parallelism of syntactic structures, adjective, noun, adjective, noun, a kind of parallelism important to prose, for parallelism of patterns of stress, a parallelism characteristic of verse. Finally, the speaker significantly alters line 145. Shakespeare wrote, do grow beneath their shoulders this to hear. But Booth reads, do grow beneath their shoulders these things to hear. The result is that the rhythm of the line at the end of the line is totally disrupted. The speech in this recording has a colloquial ease which gives the performance compelling authenticity. However, the 58 lines of this passage are cluttered with unmetrical misreadings. The adoption of the conversational style did not lead to a keen sensitivity to the music of the Shakespearean line. If this reading is representative, we should think of Booth as reading Shakespeare as if the dramatist was a master of prose rather than of verse. Recent recordings show that today's performers have not improved on Booth in regard to displaying the music of Shakespeare's verse. But we still must be concerned about whether such inattention is something Booth inherited or whether it is his own contribution to the history of acting. To make a decision about that question, we need to consider the recordings of his English contemporaries. The recordings we have of Sir Henry Irving actually antedate those of Booth. Colonel George E. Garrard, Edison's agent in England, gave one of the first machines to cross the Atlantic as a wedding gift to Sir Henry Stanley, the great African explorer. Stanley and his wife, Lady Dorothy, set about recording their friends. Irving was among them. From these recordings, made, we are told, in one case on May 9, 1898, that must be 1889, we have two speeches by Irving, 24 lines of the opening soliloquy from Richard III, and a speech by Wolsey from the last scene of the third act of Henry VIII. The handout you have provides a complete text of each of these recordings. The woman who introduces the recording of Richard III is probably Lady Dorothy. The fuller introduction to the speech of Wolsey is evidently provided by Sir Henry Stanley. Their words are at the top and bottom of the page. I have marked certain changes in the wording that Irving introduces by putting a box around the passage. And at the end, I have underlined an original ending that Irving has given to the passage.
Henry Irving.
9th of May, 1898.
Here is
the
winter of
our discontent. With glorious summer, I discomfort all. All the sounds of the tower upon our house, in the deep bosom of the ocean. Now are our prows crowned with victorious wreath, our crews at arms and up for monument, our colonel Aaron dead, the very meeting, our dreadful Martinez, the delightful banner. Grim is it war, absolute is regal strength, and now instead of mounting our best steed to fight the souls of fearful adversaries, in the
Even with the interference with the sound, we can note a difference in the voice qualities selected for each of the two roles, and we can discern far greater variety in each speech than is evident in Booth's recording from Othello. However, those who are disposed to think of Shakespeare's text as sacred writ must also be impressed by the number and variety of changes Irving introduces into Shakespeare's blank verse lines. The most benign, and perhaps the most obvious, are the substitutions of one word for another. In Henry VIII, lay for sleep in line 6, who for that in line 8, I forgot to mark that one, and road for way in line 10. In Richard III, formed for shaped in line 14, and me for my in line 20, though in the last case I am not certain whether this is properly called a substitution, for since Booth made a similar change in the speech from Othello, this might be considered an alternative pronunciation. None of these changes is particularly important, for each retains both the sense and the meter of the line. In other cases, the flow of the line is inappropriately disrupted. For instance, when Irving mistakenly uses a trisyllabic pronunciation of envious, which should be envious. Here, synesthesis should come into play. Ah, there's a new word for you. Synesthesis, S-Y-N-E-Z-E-S-I-S, is a name given to a common linguistic phenomenon, the fusion of vowels and adjacent syllables into a consonant vowel combination. When we change glorious to glorious, for instance. victorious to victorious. We do it all the time. It's a perfectly common phenomenon that we've given a 50-cent, our linguists have given a 50-cent word to name. We find it when people say tejus rather than tedious, or happier rather than happier. And here we find, instead of envious, that Irving should have said envious. Synesthesis should also have reduced glorious to glorious in this passage.
Be glorious summer, I didn't just
recall. Three lines later, victorious should have been syncopated to victorious.
All the cells of the tower upon our house. Now are our crowds felt with victorious sleep.
And 10 lines later, amorous should have been shortened to amorous. Each of these alterations introduces a violation of the meter. Somewhat more surprising is the shifting of the position of a word. We find this in the last line we can hear on the recording of Richard III, where have is inserted after why. The have ought to have occurred in the next line. This change regularizes the iambic rhythm of the line, a rhythm which is disrupted by a trisyllabic second foot, as Shakespeare wrote it. But I am left wondering what Irving did with the grammar of the remainder of the speech. A simpler shift with a quite different effect is found in line 14 of the passage from Henry VIII. The then, which should have ended the line, is moved to a position in front of can.
I had been sent to the angels, Holland and man.
In Shakespeare's version, this is a normal blank verse line with an extra unaccented syllable in the 11th position, a common variation, which is seen in the second, third, and fourth lines of this passage, as well as in many other places. Irving's alteration puts the extra syllable before the caesura and closes the line with two iambic feet. This is a pattern which is quite rare. Deletions which Irving makes have a much more severe effect upon the meter. In Wolsey's speech, the deletion of and from line 11 reduces the line to 10 syllables but disrupts the iambic pattern. His deletion of thy from the beginning of line 21 removes an optional unaccented syllable, but I submit the meter would have been clearer had he retained it. The most striking deletion, however, is that of an entire section beginning with the last three words of line 22 and extending through the period in line 27. By splicing together the first part of line 22 and the last part of line 27, Irving produces a 12-syllable line with an extra syllable before the caesura, which ends the third foot, and another extra syllable at the end of the line. At first glance, this cut reminds me of ones I frequently come across in 20th century condensations. However, Irving's revisions here minimize the disruption of the blank verse. The same cannot be said of his addition to this speech. After line 30, Irving introduces an original ending which picks up the indication of an exit lost with line 28.
Let me take it to my enemies. Come, Cromwell, let us go in. My spirit is broken.
The line does not scan. The metaphor, the broken blade, does not fit the rest of the speech or the character. And the final ejaculation introduces a melodramatic element which is in conflict with the style of the rest of the speech. Other matters might be considered, pauses for instance. However, that would extend this analysis excessively. Allow me to summarize my conclusions regarding Irving by opining that on the whole we find his him showing greater concern for the music of Shakespeare's verse than I previously found in Edwin Booth's recording of Othello's speech to the Senate. However, the extent of Irving's concern is made uncertain by shifts and cuts which he introduces. Evidence of his lack of concern for meter is found in the fact that on every occasion when a word which needs to be syncopated occurs, Irving fails to perform the needed syncopation and violates the meter. The suggestion is that either Irving did not note the disruption or that he valued more highly the sound of the extended form of the word. The shortened forms were used by Shakespeare and are used today. They are used by British actors today, especially in conversation, as we note in the valuable discussions which follow the broadcast of the Shakespeare plays. But even at the time of Irving, a false notion of precision seems to have been abroad, which repeatedly led this great player to misread his lines. One final observation needs to be made at this point. Each of the speeches which Irving recorded is rather formal. Neither is conversational in tone, nor especially passionate. The significance of this observation will be made clear in the consideration of the recordings of Ellen Terry. The British actress made several recordings of readings from Shakespeare on February 21st and 28th, 1911, in the Victor Studios in New York. She made 7 recordings in the first session, of which 3 were found acceptable for distribution. At the second session, she made 3 recordings, the first 2 of which were released and are, to my mind, her most important recordings. These are the only ones I will deal with here. Having made 2 unsatisfactory recordings of Portia's mercy speech from The Merchant of Venice during the first session, she repeated the effort at the beginning of the second session, and the reading was issued as Victor 64194 and His Master's Voice 2-3535.
Quality of mercy is not the same. It droppeth as the gentle rain from heaven upon the place beneath. It is twice blessed. It blesseth him that gives and him that takes. Is mightiest in the mightiest. It becomes the throned monarch better than his crown. His scepter shows the force of temporal power, the attribute to awe and to majesty, wherein justice the dread and fear of kings. But mercy is above this sceptered sway. It is enthroned in the heart of kings. It is an attribute to God himself. And earthly power doth then show likest God when mercy sees justice. Therefore, Jew, bold justice be thy plea. Consider this, that in the course of justice none of us should see salvation. We do pray for mercy, and that same prayer doth teach us all to render the deed of mercy.
Characterized by an inflated, oratorical, and pompous quality, this passage contains a far greater proportion of meter-violating mispronunciations than any of the other issued recordings. Line 189 should be a regular blank verse line, with mightiest reduced to mightiest. However, Terry clearly uses a hypermetrical trisyllabic pronunciation, mightiest, and changes the word in its second occurrence to mightier.
Mightiest in the mightiest.
Here, let me go back and see if I can get that whole thing.
Is mightiest in the mightiest.
In the next line, she neglects the pronunciation temporal and says temporal instead.
Scripture shows the force of temporal power.
In line 196, she changes himself to in heaven.
It is an attribute to God in heaven.
Increasing the number of words in the passage and introducing a feminine ending by using the disyllabic pronunciation of heaven, a word which is nearly always monosyllabic, at least through the 18th century. In the following line, she introduces an extra syllable by using the disyllabic pronunciation of power, P-O-W-E-R, which should have been, she says power, it should have been pronounced par.
And earthly power doth then show likeness to God.
Here we see that expanded pronunciations are clearly associated with elevation and dignity, and that Shakespeare did not expect these forms to be used in this passage. A quite different reading, a more intimate and colloquial one, is suggested as what Shakespeare wanted. The next recording was a reading of the potion scene from Romeo and Juliet. It is hard to accept a 64-year-old actress playing Juliet, and indeed I think her voice too mature for the role. Nevertheless, her reading is far superior to that provided by the next actress to record scenes involving Juliet, the 55-year-old Julia Marlowe. And in my opinion, Terry's remains one of the best.
Good night. Get thee to bed and rest, for thou hast need. Farewell. God knows when we shall meet again. I have a faint cold fear thrills through my veins that almost freezes up into the heat of life. I'll call them back again to comfort me. Nurse! Oh, what should she do here? My dismal scene, I need must ask alone. Come, vial. What is this mixture you not work at all? Shall I be married again tomorrow morning? No, no. This shall forbid it. Lie down there. What did it be upon which the friar suddenly hath ministered to have me dead, lest in this marriage he should be dishonored, because he married me before to Romeo? I fear it is. And yet, methinks it should not, for he hath still been tried a holy man. How if, when I am laid into the tomb, I wake before the time that Romeo comes to redeem me? There, a fearful point. Shall I not then be stifled in the vault to whose foul mouth no healthsome air breathes in, and there die, strangled, ere my Romeo comes? Or, if I live, is it not very like the horrible conceit of death and night, together with the terror of the place, as in a vault, an ancient receptacle where for these many hundred years the bones of all my buried ancestors are packed, where bloody gibbets, yet the green in earth, lies festering in his throat, where, as they say, at some hours in the night, spirits resort. Alas, alas, is it not like that I, so early waking, what with loathsome smells and shrieks like mandrakes torn out of the earth, the living mortals hearing them run mad? Oh! If I wake, shall I not be distraught and violence in all these hideous fears and madly play in my forefather's joint, and thrust the mangled gibbet from his throne, and with this rage, with some great kinsman's bone, as with a club, dash out my desperate brain. Oh, making I see my cousin's ghost, seeking out Romeo, that it fits his body upon a rapier's point. Oh, stay! Gibbon, stay! Ah, Romeo, I come. This do I drink.
Here, the pomp and dignity of Portia's mercy speech is clearly inappropriate, and Terry never uses the extended pronunciations which marred her previous effort. At line 53, desperate is clearly syncopated. She also accurately pronounces festering in line 42, where the syncopation is indicated by an apostrophe.
Festering in the smoke. Where is they say?
Her grace would be unworthy of mention if we did not find the line misread by Janet Riker in the Marlowe Society recording. Come on, Janet. By Claire Bloom in the Shakespeare Recording Society version. That's, And by Rebecca Sayer in the televised production as part of the Shakespeare plays. Terry also recognizes the need for synesthesis to reduce hideous to hideous and rapier to rapier in lines 49 and 56. Riker mishandled these lines. Bloom mishandles them.
I am a point.
It is not surprising that alone among these actresses, Terry consistently recognized that in each occurrence in this passage, the name of the man, R-O-M-E-O, is pronounced disyllabically, Romeo, not Romeo. Consider these readings by Jeanette Riker.
Awake before the time that Romeo come to redeem. And then I strangled ere my Romeo come. Seeking out Romeo that had spit his body. Romeo, come. This do I drink to thee.
Or These by Clara Bloom.
Because he married me before to Romeo. Awake before the time that Romeo comes. And then I strangled ere my Romeo comes. Seeking out Romeo that had spit his body upon a rock. Romeo, come. This do I drink to thee.
Or These by Rebecca Sayer.
Because he married me before the moon. Then before the time that Romeo comes. As I strangled ere my Romeo come, so seeking out Romeo that spit his body upon a... Romeo, I come. This do I drink to thee.
Perhaps the best evidence of Terry's concern with meter is found in our reading of line 38. I find the pronunciation receptacle rather odd, and I have not found anyone else using that pronunciation. Here is Janet Riker.
As you before, arranged from the receptacle.
Wait, that's Ellen Terry, yeah. Here comes Janet Riker.
As in a vault, an ancient receptacle.
However, the result for Terry is a reading that is both emotional and metrical. Notice that although a punctuation mark occurs at the end of nearly every line, none is found at the end of lines 23, 30, 39, 54, and 55. I have that all marked 43 on the right-hand side. Notice that in each case, she uses the pause of suspension, to use Thomas Sheridan's term, to maintain the integrity of the blank verse line.
What did you see upon? Which the flyer, fashion cut miniature to Anglin Flowers. On the right, the pause of time. This Romeo comes to redeem me.
Edwin Booth does not use the pause of suspension in these positions, and even runs together lines separated by a punctuation mark. Although Terry was quite fond of Booth, her style is markedly different from his. This brief analysis will allow us to form a number of probable hypotheses regarding the pronunciation and the concern for meter in American and British acting about the turn of the century. First, English performers maintained a concern for metrical accuracy and the flow of Shakespeare's blank verse. Second, by the turn of the century, even English performers used hypermetrical expanded pronunciations of syncopatable words in order to lend dignity and elevation to a passage. Third, Booth introduced to American acting a greater lack of concern for the rhythm of verse. Whatever advantage his conversational style had over what preceded it, it seems to be responsible for the decline in metrical readings, which subsequently has become common on both sides of the Atlantic. Thank you, Bob. We're... You check out of your rooms. Okay.